This weekend starts right after this.
As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
The roller coaster of unity and division. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
Why does America's cohesiveness tend to fall apart so quickly after a unifying event? A deep dive on patriotism by USA Today.
For the fourth time in a little more than a year, the U.S. Army has liberated Atropia. A story about military games later in the hour.
Despite the wrath of Hurricane Irma in the Florida Keys, the party didn't slow down much in Key West. Hear what some claim are their new survival essentials.
And what the tech industry can do to better help prepare for and manage catastrophic storms like Harvey and Irma.
We could do a lot of things with regard to constructing material and how we built houses, built them up instead of down, built them out of things like fiberglass that's very resistant to wind and certainly collisions with things like flying branches and debris.
Tech analyst Rob Enderle on what we need from technology when it comes to storms. He's here later in the hour. Well, after terrorists murdered nearly 3,000 people on September 11, 2001, Americans swiftly responded with fellowship and patriotism. Remember that? People of different races and religions consoled one another at candlelight vigils. Others tattooed stars and stripes on their bodies. American flags rose up in neighborhoods across the nation. Today, much of that cohesion has crumbled. Americans fight bitterly about everything from gun control to Obamacare. It's a story by Laura Petreca, senior editor of Special Projects at USA Today. Laura, give us the broad setup.
So the broad setup is he wants to take a look at the country now, all these years after September 11th, and examine the division that we often see in America in this day and age and compare it to the unity that we saw and felt after the September 11th attacks.
Seems like we're not happy, I guess, if we're not complaining or bitching about something. Where did the divide begin after 9/11? Where did it resume, perhaps?
Actually, based on the interviews I did, it seemed like it resumed pretty quickly after September 11th. So you have people that came together in unity, and then suddenly you get to debate really serious hot-button issues, such as how do you fight a war on terror? And then what do you do about people that suddenly are prejudiced against other people? So all of a sudden, all of these things started coming up pretty soon after the attacks.
Jeez. All right, so what do some of the stats say about the divisions? What'd you find there?
We found a really interesting statistic from Gallup. So Gallup polls Americans on how patriotic they feel. Like, pretty much, are they extremely proud to be an American? How do they feel about their pride in America? And they've been doing it since 2001. The year after the attacks, they hit a high point. So both Republicans and Democrats felt extremely proud to be an American. This year, however, there's a big divide. It's the largest ever gap between Democrats and Republicans. You've got Republicans still extremely proud to be an American, but Democrats, not as much so.
Hmm. I thought it was interesting, too, and I always find this aspect interesting. Social media, which you say gave Americans a megaphone to share these different views. Anybody, I don't know, try to figure out how social media has factored in here?
Well, I talked to a few experts, and they talked quite frequently about the rise of social media. So you've got more outlets than ever to express your opinion. And by the way, you can do it 24/7. People have that phone on their nightstand at night. Yeah. They've got it in their pocket during the day. So you can express your opinion all the time. It doesn't really take a lot of thought for you to quickly type some things on your phone. So some of the studies that we found determined that people tend to be a little less respectful on social media. They tend to be a bit angrier. And you could see that, right? So when you're face-to-face with someone, you tend to be a little more polite than you would not being face-to-face with them in discussions. So you've got all these factors. You have the rise of social media, Facebook, Twitter, all these other sites where you can express your opinion. You have 24/7 access through the phone in your pocket all the time. And you're not having these face-to-face communications. So it's really easy to just fire off a note to somebody in terms of a Facebook post or put out a tweet or argue with your uncle or argue with another relative on Facebook.
Yeah. Boy, with all due respect to First Amendment rights and free speech, I wonder, right, if there were no social media, would there be more civility?
I know, right? That's a great question. I will say the positive about social media is that you can express your opinions and you can get them out there, and people can make a really big difference by having a movement getting going. Yeah. So you can get a movement going by posting things and getting your opinions out there. The trick is to try to really do it in a respectful way.
Mm. We're speaking with Laura Petreca, Senior Editor for Special Projects at USA Today. She's written a piece entitled America's Division. We united in the wake of 9/11, then partisanship reemerged. What else jumped out at you as you were piecing this together?
Wow, one of the big things that jumped out to me while I was piecing it together is the big diversity of opinions out there in terms of what we should do and how we can get there in terms of bringing our country together. But really one of my favorite things that came out was when I was speaking to a person who studied American studies. So it was a director of American studies who just has a big background in this area. And he and others I spoke to said, get used to the division. This is just America. We are a country of all different people, all different religions, all different races, and the diversity is what makes us great. Now, sure, we're not arguing in the most respectful way, but we've been arguing for a long, long time. We argued well before 9/11. We're going to argue well past 9/11. And some of these debates really make us a healthy, robust democracy.
So I'm reading between the lines, it's just our presentation perhaps needs to be better. It's like my mom used to tell me, don't talk to me in that tone. It's okay if you want to express a different opinion, but do not use that tone with me.
Exactly. So you agree to disagree, and it's all those type of like cliches, right? Like in terms of agreeing to disagree and treat people the way you want to be treated. But they're all true as you think about it. So before you fire off that note on Facebook to somebody who posted something that you are offended by, think about how you want to phrase that.
Thanks, Laura. Laura Petreca, Senior Editor of Special Projects at USA Today. 13 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. Who takes care of the men and women on the front lines when they're taking care of everyone else in disaster situations like Hurricanes Harvey and Irma? The USO. With an update on what the organization is up to, we're joined now by Alan Reyes, Senior Vice President of Operations and Programs. Alan, what is USO doing?
We are really privileged to provide support to our service members that are providing disaster relief efforts both in Texas and Florida in the aftermath of Harvey and Irma. And as everyone knows, when you have these natural disasters, you've got the National Guard, you've got the Coast Guard, you've got all the different armed forces, particularly given the magnitude of these relief efforts, descending down there on Texas and Florida. And we as a USO, in our ability to always be by the side of those service members and their families, are there alongside them. We're providing relief, support and comfort through things like our expeditionary vehicles that we're setting up, these temporary USOs, so that they can have a place to relax and recharge when they're off of their mission. We're also sending thousands and thousands of care packages down to Texas and Florida, much like the tens of thousands of care packages we sent to service members around the world.
Boy, we often don't think of those guys as being on the front lines. We hear the rescue stories and survival stories and all that other stuff, but we often forget the guys who are on those front lines that they need caring also. What is it that you do generally?
Well, so, you know, just like we have 200-plus USO centers around the world, these centers that we're setting up right there at these camps, these temporary locations, are places where the service members can relax. We have food, we have drinks, water, snacks. We have gaming and television and things that they can do just to unwind, just to relax after a pretty arduous day performing their duties. But most importantly, we also provide them a way to connect back home. Especially when you think about the challenges of connectivity with phone and internet in a disaster relief scenario, you know, we have provide the opportunity for them to call home, to connect to home through our own network of satellite and bandwidth connectivity. And that's another way for them to stay in touch. And, you know, we know that our role in the USO is to strengthen our service members. And one of those ways to strengthen them is really to connect them back home. And that's true whether they're sitting there at a National Guard camp in Florida or whether they're sitting in a forward operating base in Afghanistan.
Wow. We're speaking with Alan Reyes. He's Senior VP of Operations and Programs of the USO. You guys stretch kind of thin right now. I mean, obviously you got some overseas operations, and now we got two big hurricanes you're dealing with.
Yeah, you know, we're stretched, but I tell you, it's a good stretch. We are so fortunate and blessed. We've got over 30,000 volunteers around the world that execute the USO mission, and so we have capacity to be able to serve them on a day-to-day basis. Serve our service members and their families on a day-to-day basis, and then be able to respond to contingencies like what's happening in Harvey and Irma. And, you know, even as an aside, you know, in some of the recent tragedies in the Pacific, these collisions at sea that the Navy experienced, we are supporting in the aftermath the crews and the families of those ships because we know that that's an important thing to do. And so that's, you know, one of the things that we do as the USO is we're as nimble as we can to always be by their side, and we do that because we've got the great support not only our volunteers, but all of our donors and supporters that make this an opportunity that we can realize.
How do regular folks get involved here or help out?
Yeah, you know, I'd love if anyone wants to learn more about what we're doing as the USO and what they can do to support that, they can visit our website at uso.org/force. And they can learn how to be part of the force behind the forces. That's our term for talking about the great work that anyone can do in society to demonstrate to our service members that we want them to be strong and that we want to be part of strengthening them. They can learn how to volunteer. They can even send a simple message of support that we can send out to our service members through our USO centers as well.
Thanks, Alan. Alan Reyes, Senior VP of Operations and Programs of the USO. It's an organization always in beast mode in disasters, right? 21 minutes now after the hour. On this weekend, glad you're with us. So in less than a month, families with high school seniors should be ready to fill out the free application for federal student aid. The FAFSA form becomes available October 1, and families with students entering or enrolled in college need to complete it if they wish to apply for federal and state financial aid for the 2018 and 19 academic year. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
It's almost time for families with college-bound students to fill out the free application for federal student aid, or FAFSA. Veronica Dagger of the Wall Street Journal is here with some tips. Veronica, who should fill out this form?
So financial advisors and financial aid experts tell me everyone, even if you're super wealthy, they recommend doing it because the FAFSA is not only used by the federal government, or rather the government, to determine who is eligible for federal and state aid in the form of grants and loans, but also many schools require the form for merit aid, which isn't based on your finances. Merit aid is based on, say, your kid is doing well academically or does well in sports, or sometimes these schools just have these random scholarships they want to give away. And often you're going to need to fill out that FAFSA in order to apply for that.
Step one, Veronica, is the Federal Student Aid ID. What is that and how do you go about getting it?
Yeah, so get that ID as soon as possible. You can go to fsaid.ed.gov, and basically, and you and your kid, your child who's applying to college, both need their own IDs. And basically, it's an electronic signature that you're going to need to use the online FAFSA system to fill out that application and also sign, quote-unquote, electronically sign that application. And so everybody's going to get their own ID and password. And the sooner you do that, the better, just because last year and prior years, this has been a little tricky for some people. A lot of people were logging onto that website at the same time, and some people reported problems with it. Also, some people make mistakes when filling out the information needed to apply for that ID. For example, some people will use the same email address that their child is using for that for the ID, and every single FAFSA ID account needs to have their own email address associated with that.
We're speaking with Veronica Dagger of the Wall Street Journal. Veronica, what kinds of tax documents and other kinds of documents do you need for the FAFSA form?
So the tax documents are the biggies. So for the FAFSA that's going to become available October 1st, you're going to be using your tax returns from 2016, so 2 years ago. And so the FAFSA you're going to be applying for on October 1st, starting October 1st, that's going to be for money for the 2018-2019 academic year. So it's tax returns from 2 years prior. So use those 2016 tax returns. You're also going to want to have information such as your most recent bank and brokerage account statements. at the ready. And those account statements are the most recent statements you have. So for example, the assets on those statements are reported of the date the FAFSA is filed, not from 2 years ago, but like very recently. So that's something you want to have available. There's also something called the IRS data retrieval tool that you should be able to use when the FAFSA goes live October 1st. And basically that IRS data retrieval tool will automatically pull that information from your 2016 tax returns into your FAFSA. So it'll basically save you some time in filling out information on that FAFSA.
Veronica, this all sounds rather complicated. Is this a tough form to fill out?
You know, I know. I always feel bad. It's actually, of the forms, there's this one, there's a FAFSA, and then there's this thing called a CSS profile. And I'm told by people who fill these out regularly, the FAFSA is actually easier, generally speaking, than the CSS profile. And that profile is used to often apply for aid at some of the elite schools around the country where FAFSA is used by everybody. But, you know, take your time with it. Start early. Gather your information. There's some tutorials online that you can look at. And, you know, just take your time with it. And I would say if you can, do the application in one shot. It kind of can be confusing for you and your family if you're going back and forth over several days doing it. I mean, if you have to do that, do that. But if you can just sit down, spend a couple hours one morning, and just bang it out, it might make it easier for you and just have it out of your hair.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenko with Wall Street Journal reporter Veronica Dagger. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Thanks for being with us, Gordon Deal, with Jennifer Koshenko. Coming up this half hour, what the tech industry might consider doing about storms like Harvey and Irma. Also, after multiple invasions, why the U.S. Army is growing weary of liberating Atropia. It's a story about war games. And damage might be heavy on Key West, but that hasn't slowed down the party much. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at MichiganBusiness.org. Contact them today. How can cities and businesses better protect themselves from floodwaters like we've seen in Houston and parts of Florida with the recent hurricanes? Adam Goldberg of Aquafence USA has some ideas. He and his company are in Houston volunteering time and resources. Adam, what is Aquafence about?
Aquafence is a deployable flood barrier that can be erected in a matter of a few hours around a building, a municipality, or really any site that's prone to flooding.
What's it made of?
It's made of Baltic laminate, marine-grade plywood, stainless steel, and aluminum. And you can deploy 100 linear feet of this in 1 hour with only four people. So it's very responsive, and it involves little to no advanced work to the site.
No kidding. How I don't know. So could Houston have called you, for example? Could you have helped there?
Yeah, you know, I mean, what happened in Houston is obviously horrible, and no, we could not have saved all of Houston from flooding, but certain things like chemical plants, for example, there was one that exploded.
Yeah.
We certainly could have been there around their generators. We do a lot of work, you know, saving parts of buildings, manufacturing plants, warehouses, commercial properties. We could have definitely limited the damage to some of the properties here. Wow. Unfortunately, you can't stop it all, no matter what.
We're speaking with Adam Goldberg of Aquafence. He's the director of Aquafence USA, based in New Jersey. I know you don't do homes, more commercial and municipal, obviously, but generally speaking, do you offer advice to homeowners? Because I know you kind of turned the thumbs down on sandbags before, at least for maybe some bigger properties.
Yeah, I mean, you know, advice to homeowners is if flood insurance is available, I would always have it. I think it's great to prevent water from getting into your house. And, you know, you could use a system like ours to block your driveway, for example, or water from getting in your garage. I would just always be careful that structurally you don't damage the building, because a lot of houses were not designed to hold up to, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 feet of water's worth of pressure on the outside. And if you block water from coming into your house, it could actually do more damage structurally if there's nothing to counteract it on the inside.
Oh, because you could be creating more pressure than that on other walls, for example?
Correct. Oh. Correct. Oh. Correct. You know, in Manhattan, for example, during Sandy, there were a lot of windows that did not break. And there were 6 feet of water up against them. And the building owners would say, oh, my windows are perfect. They didn't break. And they're not realizing that that's because there was also 6 feet of water on the inside.
Mm.
The minute you take that water out of the inside, you're amassing a pressure that, you know, most structures are not designed to hold, certainly not most residential houses.
Thanks, Adam. It's Adam Goldberg from Aquafence USA. It is 22 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. The tech industry can have a bigger impact in preparing for and responding to storms like Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. Here's how from tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. Rob, what did you look at?
The technology industry has a lot of tools in which to apply to a problem like this, and everything from setting up grids for drones, which, by the way, is they're trying to do, to make search patterns much tighter, but also helping design structures that could survive both a hurricane and a surge. So you add houses that weren't leveled when something like this happened. And in many cases, these structures could be manufactured in centralized facilities and shipped out either intact or in pieces to be assembled very quickly after a hurricane. So not only could you get people back in homes very quickly, but the next time a hurricane went through, these homes would not be the ones that were collapsed.
What do you mean, by the way, when you say technology can be a force multiplier?
Well, so what happens is when I'm talking about a force multiplier is when you take and you add drones to a person, to a single person now is the equivalent of 100 people searching. If you add technology to a house, rather than having a whole bunch of people building a house that's going to be leveled, you have a few people building a house centrally in a factory that will stand during an event. So what technology does is it takes the power of one person and can make it multiply it by 100 times to make them far more effective. I mean, even people carrying drones could fly in and pick up folks that are stranded on roofs and fly them back out again, as opposed to having to use boats and some of the other relatively unsafe methods that folks are currently using. Because, you know, you've got downed power lines. We had a number of people electrocuted because there were power lines underneath the water that they couldn't see and died as they attempted to rescue people or pets.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, too. It talked about drones. Didn't you say drones or perhaps drones that are boats could spot some of these hot spots and notify electric companies or emergency responders that, hey, there's a live wire underwater here?
Absolutely. You don't actually have to have people in the boats. You could actually have the boats looking for people that are remote controlled or robotically controlled, and they could sense the lines in the high current and say, okay, this is an area you don't want anybody live going into because there's live current underneath the water. Either turn off the current down there or just avoid the area, and of course the electronics would survive the electricity where people would not.
Mm. We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the tech advisory firm The Enderle Group. He's written a piece entitled What the Tech Industry Should Be Doing About Harvey and Irma. Go into logistics a little bit, because as you point out, this could be a way to eliminate a lot of government waste.
Absolutely. You know, a lot of the companies like, say, Dell are expert on logistics. And they know how to get material to a certain area as cheaply and as quickly as possible. That's their level of expertise. And applied to a problem like this, you could certainly solve a lot of the problems which have to do with graft, have to do with waste, have to do with just having the wrong thing in the wrong place at the wrong time. These advanced logistics technologies allow you to have the right thing at the right place at the wrong time, not only anticipating a problem, but making sure there isn't this level of waste, because a lot of the money that's spent on recovering from a disaster is just wasted because things are sent to the wrong place, it's the wrong stuff in the wrong location, or you've got people taking advantage of the situation and kind of milking the opportunity. A lot of that stuff can be solved by tech companies because they've had to solve it for themselves.
What was the example you gave about communications with Cisco and that TacOps team that they have?
Well, Cisco is one of the unique firms that actually deploys their technology in a disaster. And so they've got a TacOps team and a specialized truck that goes into a disaster area and assures their communications so that first responders can get back to doctors. They can coordinate with each other and help locate folks that are in trouble and get help to them as quickly as possible. Because a lot of times when you have a disaster like this, the cell towers come down, the networks come down, certainly all the telephone lines come down. Mm. And so these fast responders, these trucks can roll out and restore wireless communications, get their digital networks up, get their voice networks up, and get people communicating again. You know, communications are about 90% of the problem after disaster, and certainly we found that in 9/11 when the old BlackBerry network stayed up. It allowed people to communicate when everything else went down.
How about just the whole idea of building better homes and cities? Dive into that a little more.
Well, that's kind of sad for me because, you know, Walt Disney was a big proponent of that, and his Epcot Center was actually supposed to be a city, but he was betrayed by his attorneys, and so that never worked out, and then, of course, he died. But his whole idea was to build a city that could withstand something like this, and his House of the Future was built around the time I was born. I was around when they tried to tear the thing down, and they hit it with a wrecking ball and almost took out the crane because the wrecking ball bounced back so far. The damn thing was indestructible, and that was in the 1950s. So we could do a lot of things with regard to constructing material and how we built houses, built them up instead of down, built them out of things like fiberglass that's very resistant to wind and certainly collisions with things like flying branches and debris.
Thanks, Rob. It's tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the tech advisory firm called the Enderle Group. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend.
If you're familiar with cloud computing, you probably know that Amazon Web Services offers a complete set of secure compute, storage, application, and deployment services that help companies launch and scale their IT infrastructures while lowering costs. But did you know that you're still responsible for protecting your own AWS-based assets, meaning your applications and data, from advanced cyber threats? Protect your AWS with Barracuda Network's advanced firewall solutions. Visit AWS Marketplace or barracuda.com/AWS to learn more.
Thanks for being with us. Cool story about war games from the Wall Street Journal. The U.S. Army's Training Command in 2012 developed a rich backstory for various phony countries in its war games. The fictional country of Atropia, according to the playbook, is a pro-Western dictatorship. The Army ordered its training centers adopt the scenario. It's liberated quite frequently. More from Wall Street Journal reporter James Marson, who's based in Moscow. James, explain what this is about.
So this is about military exercises that militaries across the world use to practice not only using weapons, but also the various political scenarios that they may face. So this particular scenario was in use for several years, but it ended up being a little controversial. So some people in the American Army were a little frustrated with having to liberate it so many times. Then there were also problems with some European militaries because in the scenario with Atropia, it was described as a dictatorship. Some European armies weren't particularly happy, even within the military, even though it was a scenario, they weren't happy about having to defend a dictatorship. And then there was another problem. Then there was another problem, which was that even though Atropia is a made-up country, it was pretty obvious that this effectively represented Azerbaijan, a country in the South Caucasus. Now, there were two other fake countries, one which more or less represented Armenia and another which more or less represented Turkey. And the Turkish army were not particularly happy that a town which they considered Turkish was placed into the ersatz Armenia. And so they called up an American general and complained. So these fake countries, as it turns out, can cause arguments between NATO allies.
That's unbelievable. I got a kick out of the one soldier you talked to. He said he's tired of liberating Atropia. It's been four times in 15 months or something like that.
That's right. Well, the American Army has to step in wherever it's needed.
So, as you mentioned, though, like the U.S. obviously is not the only one that does this. Who else has these games with fake country names?
Well, it's caused a very interesting situation at the moment, in fact, because the Russian and Belarusian armies are currently, they're about to start exercises, big exercises called the Zapad exercises. As part of these exercises, they've made public a map. One of the scenarios involves a fake country called Veshnoria. Now, Belarus, which is an ally of Russia, it's a small country that used to be a Soviet republic. It's been ruled for more than 20 years by a dictator. Some Belarusians have taken this idea of this made-up country called Veshnoria, and they're using that to imagine what it would be like to live not in a dictatorship. They've made their own flag, they've made a national anthem, they've made passports, and so they're having real fun with this idea online.
It's Wall Street Journal reporter James Marson on his cell phone from Moscow. Yeah, don't book any airfare to Veshnoya or Atropia. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. You didn't think a massive storm like Hurricane Irma was going to stop the party in the Florida Keys, did you? Irma devastated the Keys, a string of low-lying islands trailing Florida's southern coast, flooding what appears to be hundreds of homes, trailers, and RVs as the storm passed directly over the chain. Utility workers are racing to restore power. Gas remains in short supply. Few stores are open. Palm trees snapped off at the base, coconuts littering the roads. But USA Today says for guys like 68-year-old Rit McClintock, who rode out the storm under his hotel bed in Key West, if the booze wasn't flowing, that's when he'd be concerned. The day after the storm, he was sipping a frosty drink at the Bourbon Street Pub, normally home to drag queens and a clothing-optional garden. He and his buddy Ed came to Key West last week to celebrate his 72nd birthday. He got stuck when the airport closed ahead of the storm. Paul Rick, a 22-year-old Key West resident, said, "This is normal for Key West." He says, "As long as we've got a generator and booze, we're happy." Oh, and they don't always need the generator, he said. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.